Hi, and welcome to episode 104 of Fully Boosted, a War Machine and Hordes podcast. My name is Pete.
I'm Brad.
And I'm Matt.
And tonight we are flying Grantless. He has a wedding or some type of wedding plan or something wedding related that he has to get to. So it's just us three guys. How you fellas doing tonight?
So I'm doing well. I just rushed home from work to talk to you guys. And I'm very, very excited for OTC.
I'm good. I saw Cold Pursuit today. It was pretty enjoyable, gruesome movie. And
is that a car chase in Canada, or is that actually a film?
It's a film with Liam Neeson where he murders a bunch of people. Good times. Besides that, I'm good. I'm pretty hyped for OTC. Looking forward to this discussion we're gonna have, and I can't wait to play some War Machine with you boys.
Well, some of us boys. So sadly, I won't be at OTC. I'm going to take just before we get to the topic of the night. I just want to get your guys's opinion, since both of you will be coming to the event. The lists were posted. This is event 610 on Conflict Chamber. 31 Circle. What are your thoughts there on that? I know that's a Lord of the Feast is a hot button item right now. And Circle being pretty, you know, there's some calls that Circle could be at the tip of the power curve. What are your guys' thoughts into that much Circle?
So I mean, I've been predicting Circle as a powerhouse in the meta for a little while, and a lot of my lists have been really teched out at solving the problem. And I think that just like later Mark II and at some points during Mark III, whenever there's a faction that stands, kind of ahead above every other faction, if you would, it becomes the target of all of the tech in the meta and everyone trying to beat it. It's a great faction with lots of tools and lots of really strong models. And the 31 people, did you say?
31, yep.
31 people playing it are playing fast, obviously models they enjoy and models that feel powerful. And they're not villains for doing so. But man, do I hate playing against Lord of the Feast.
Yeah, I've seen many posts on Lord of the Feast. In fact, Worm of Hordes general group on Facebook just changed their name to Lord of the Feast group. That was pretty cool.
Well, Lord of the Feast general is going to be Lord of the Feast general for a month because you can't change the name within 28 days of changing a group name. So it's going to be like that for the next month.
Classic.
Wow.
But to Matt's point as well, having a faction at the top of a meta is fine and actually something that I would prefer. Knowing that Circle is going to be at the top and kind of knowing what you have to plan for, whether it's Circle, Menoth, scoring, et cetera, as long as you know what you have to plan for and you're able to build lists for that, it gives you a really great starting point for your lists. If a meta didn't have anything that was defining at the time and it was just the Wild West, say for example, and I don't think it's coming up, so not to start a rumor mill, but if tomorrow was like a Mark III reset or the beginning of Mark IV and it was going to become the Wild West again, to where no one knows what's coming, lists are really all over the place and it's impossible to plan. Having it like this, even if you would say that Circle's ahead of the curve in terms of the strength the faction represents, it gives you a mark to aim for. Like it lets you know, like if you can aim to beat the general Circle list that you should expect to see, the Iona, the Kruger II, Wormwood, kind of really those are the big three, I'd say. If you have a list or a list pair in mind that handles those lists or at least gives you game into those, it means that you are able to handle a majority of the meta and it's a great launching point. Without that front runner, it makes it so that planning is so much more difficult.
Yeah, I agree with everything Bradley just said. Just like when Ghost Fleet was really popular, it gave focus to every faction's tool set and let us kind of explore deeper into what tools the factions each needed. Having something that is obviously a focus of our attention not only highlights what we need in our list, but also what our factions could be needing in the future.
Yep, to keep echoing, kind of bouncing off each other, when Ghost Fleet was the front runner, you saw a lot of the new inclusions for each faction as like CID processes would go around and new releases came out. to offer magic weapons to factions that didn't have those as options as readily available. And I would argue now that as we get into a meta that has as many medium base tough models that have multi wounds, I think you see an uptick in the amount of grievous wounds or takedown or mortality effects that exist in the game. I think having that front runner exists is fine, and then having CIDs address areas from factions that don't have the tools to play into them only keeps changing what the meta will be in the future. I guarantee you a year from now, maybe two or three of these factions at the top of OTC if we use this as our measuring point. But some of these ones at the bottom are likely going to be back up there again. We don't know where the CIA is going to be going. But mercenaries being second to the bottom, I find it very doubtful that in a year from now they're going to be second to last again.
I mean, we're talking about in popularity, not in terms of power.
So they don't always go hand in hand. They do follow a little bit of a correlation, but they're definitely not one for one kind of translation like that.
So I think that Mercs is an extremely powerful faction, and its main limiting factor tends to be how expensive it is to collect, mm-hmm. and how it's not a fully recognized faction, and the fact that, you know, it hasn't really gotten a CID until the two it just got, which obviously has a lot of people talking and excited. But I think that most factions, if not all factions, are kind of in a seat where they have very credible answers to the meta, and mm-hmm. They don't necessarily need to ask powerful questions if they can position themselves to solve the kind of defining questions of the meta at the moment.
Absolutely.
Which is an interesting place to design factions from, and it makes CID being a very impactful tool for development of factions.
Awesome. Okay. Yes, sir. Well, sorry, Brad. I'm going to go ahead and before we totally diverge on the topic at hand here, I do want to, because we're a little bit behind. So we had received an email from listener Nicholas Steinman, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce that name, but he's from Sweden. We got this email back in the heady days of 2018, specifically in September, and we just kind of realized that. That we had gotten this email, but he wanted to have a discussion on clock, specifically death clock in War Machine. And he started off his email, and thank you, Nicholas, for giving us this email.
Before you go into the email, it wasn't like we read it in September and then fucking shelved it. We don't check that email. And then one day Grant just decided to, and then noticed that we had one from 5 months ago.
Correct.
That was about a week ago. So upon getting it, upon actually receiving it, quick turnaround. But yeah, if you just want to get in touch with us, just send us a message on Facebook or a comment. The emails we'll check every half year or so, if that.
Correct. So state of the clock, and he framed his email from the understanding that he came to War Machine with a chess background. And in chess, the clock made complete and utter sense in that you have a set amount of pieces and you have a set amount of time. Whereas in War Machine, obviously, the amount of pieces that you have to play with and the amount of decisions that you can make on clock are it's really kind of different compared to chess, right?
So chess is a game that fundamentally functions off the sense of perfect balance. All of the pieces both players possess are equal to each other, and the only key defining difference is whether you go first or second, which makes huge ramifications in the success rates of going first versus second, which is, you know, the other... There's plenty of articles written on perfect versus imperfect balance, and I don't think this is really the place to discuss it. But I will say that there is a huge difference in how you function in chess versus how you function in War Machine, especially at a high end or a medium end.
Yeah. So I think the best way to approach this is first, let's kind of set some ground rules with the clock. So in a standard 75 point game, both players get 1 hour of time. When do you pass clock? And I'm going to go, Brad, what What do you do on your time? What do you do on your opponent's time?
I think that's a little different for everyone. I think obviously you're going to take your actions on your turn. If there's anything that comes up during your opponent's turn, countercharge, arcana triggers, things of that nature, admonition triggers, anything that would involve you resolving one of your effects or moving one of your models, you should move the clock back to yourself on your opponent's turn for that. And then generally as well, if your opponent announces one of their triggers and they have not reached for their clock, it is absolutely on you to put it on them. You shouldn't give time off your clock to your opponent, nor should you expect time off your opponent's clock for yourself. Now, that being said, the tricky one has always been tough rolls within reason. I will be honest, I am not usually one that's flipping clock for tough rolls. That being said, if I've, and it happens really infrequently, I can't recall a time where I've done this, but I do know that I have, to where if it takes you time to go find your dice, especially on like a model that's like contesting a zone, I need that, like before I move on to another model, I need to know if that one's going to die or if I'm still, you know, activating around that one particular model, and you're kind of spinning your wheels trying to find your dice before you roll for that tough roll. I'll flip it to you then. But through the entire course of the game, for every tough roll, I am usually not the player that is flipping tough rolls to you for that. And I know that's always been a sticking point for players. Some do, some will not. The same thing is true with marking damage for Warjacks or Warbeasts or really anything with multi-boxes. The only time when it comes to marking damage that I know I'm like 100% always flipping clock for is when it comes to models with like Sanguine Bond or what's it called? The thing that Aaron's have. Self-sack. To where it's a trigger on your opponent's turn, they have to decide if they want to use it or not. So like if it's Sanguine Bond moving damage around, or that's where it's a trigger that you have to resolve for damage, I'm always flicking clock for that. If I had to guess, I think I'm probably in the majority of how people handle the clock. But that is a guess. Maybe there are more that flip clock back for all tough rolls than not. But I think that more people just keep going on their time than less.
Yeah. So Matt, is there any difference in Brad's approach that you employ?
So my rule is anything that requires decision is mm-hmm. on the person making the decision's time. It's a super straightforward way to handle it. If I kill a model and you have to martyrdom, Sanguine Bond, decide what to do with it, it's on your time. Decide where to put souls, that's on your time too. Anything that requires a decision process is on your time. Same thing with me. If you kill one of my models, I will flip it to my clock before I decide what to do with the soul. Unless I'm just putting it all in one spot, like really fast, whatever. Tough is a really weird one. Same thing with martyrdom. My rule is 2 to 3 seconds. If my opponent has the die ready and is ready to go and will get that first tough check done in 2 to 3 seconds, I will keep it on my time as long as I don't feel like he's abusing it. If I kill a model and he takes that like 4 or 5 seconds, whatever, to do it, and I have 5 more models to kill, we're talking about 30 seconds off my clock just because he's slow, that goes on your time. I guess the main thing is I don't want to get fucked and I don't want to fuck my opponent. So I treat them with the benefit of the doubt and assume they're not trying to fuck me. If someone starts arguing with me a lot on my clock, all bets are off. I will fuck you on your clock. Like, don't be an asshole. Treat your opponent like you expect to be treated.
Yeah, I think that's definitely that's my attitude on clock. Is it please don't ask me excessive questions. You know, if I'm gonna have a discussion about your models, I'm gonna pass the clock to myself, and we're gonna sit there and talk about your models, and then I'm gonna pass it back. I guess one of the big things that I always have a problem with is countercharge. Countercharge is kind of a got you. And it's always that game of like, you want to ask your opponent, are you done moving? But the prospect of asking that causes them to pause and say, why? Right. And so the other way would be to slap your clock and say, okay, countercharge. But you haven't acknowledged that they're done moving. So that's one of those things that I always have an issue with.
So the way I handle this is, My opponent picks up his model, puts it down. I will flip it to my clock, and I will say, I'm going to declare a countercharge. His second is hands off that model, and that model is placed. That is its final placement. Now, obviously, there's a few ways you can handle this, but I think the cleanest and most the most professional, if you would, way to handle this is after he has finished his movement, he has placed his model, you wait for him to do everything and wait for him either to go to his next model or go to his attack or go to whatever he's doing. Then you touch the clock, flip it to your time, take control of the situation, and say you are declaring a countercharge.
Yeah, so exactly what Matt's saying. It's kind of on you to own when your triggers are coming up. If you're behind and you miss doing it because your opponent's now moving their next model, unfortunately, that's kind of on you.
I mean, that's a little bit iffy, right? So, like, if he's moving a squad of guys and he moves the first guy and then he goes to pick up the second guy and is halfway through moving it and you're like, I'm countercharging. Like, well, I already moved this model. No. He went too fast. You were waiting for him to confirm. You get that countercharge.
Yeah. No, there's...
It's a rough situation. Yeah.
So it feels tough to quantify. So with testing this Venethrax list with a list of 1,000 countercharges, I haven't had a problem with getting the countercharges where I want them when I wanted them to this point. So maybe at some point in the future I'll have a point of frustration with an opponent. I'm hoping I won't, but to this point in the testing I've had, everything has worked fairly smoothly.
So I've had a few awkward countercharge situations off playing, countercharge in Kador and countercharge in Crucible Guard and in Scorn and other factions. And there's always those weird moments where your opponent's like, oh, you're countercharging me? Well, I would have just gone here instead. And that's like, I was at a smaller tournament in Northern Quebec where this happened, where I declared a countercharge with the spoiler on Zadesh 1. And my opponent goes, oh, well, I'll just move here instead. And I was like, that's not how that works. Sorry. Like, you finished your movement. You were rolling your attack roll. Like, that's not how that works. You don't then get to decide to go somewhere else. And like, that's a really awkward conversation to have because it's your opponent feels like he got gotcha'd and you're not letting him off the hook. But unfortunately, he's trying to fundamentally cheat his way out of the situation. Like it's countercharge and abilities that activate on your opponent's turn never leave anyone feeling good. They're abilities that always leave someone upset.
Yeah, 100% agree. So can you, I've never done this, is this something that you can discuss prior to the game? Can you sit there and say, hey, anytime you do something, if something on your turn, if you do an interaction that will affect my clock, I'm going to pass the clock to you, for countercharge purposes. As soon as I pass the clock, that's me declaring my countercharge, and I'm going to do it after your hand has left the model. Is it something that you can do? Or does that make sense?
So I think discussing the game in general, but with your opponent before the game makes a lot of sense, and it's something you should do. I just don't know how you have that conversation about countercharge in a way that doesn't. I don't know. I guess I would just be like, hey, look, I'm going to declare countercharges as you finish your movement. When your hand leaves the model, I'm going to assume you're done moving and declare my countercharge. If that's the conversation, then you have to hold to that frame. And that's probably the right way to do it.
So with all of the CID that occurs, and we know CID is going to be a constant. A lot of new models are coming out. There's a lot of new rules that are happening. Interactions. I know with Crucible Guard, it's a brand new faction for me. There's a lot of weird things. So with this amount of just newness in the game, is that negatively impacting clock, or is that something that you have to adapt to as you play?
So I think that probably depends on the level you're looking to play at, right? Like if it's just on your game night, the level of newness probably isn't a huge concern. Because you're just there to have a good time. If you're really competitively minded and you're looking to either win your local events or perform well on national levels or generally just looking to kind of elevate your game, I'd imagine that as these changes are rolling out, maybe not the week-to-week CID changes, but as the CID is finalized and it's put into War Room, I'd imagine that most everyone has taken the time to read through the cards or sit through a Discord, do whatever your means are to get at least familiar with the model, so that when you get to the table, it's not a complete new experience, right? Like, it'll be your first time playing against that model in its newest form or the new release model. But you'll have an idea of what they want to do. Generally, models will fit a similar role that they've existed in other factions, or a spell will have an effect that's similar in a game if it's from a new caster. So you can have a general idea of where the list is trying to go with what it's putting on the table. It's going to have a little bit of an impact on your time, but it shouldn't be, in my opinion, the reason that you're losing on clock or really getting in the hole on clock. Because that'll happen in a game where you get behind. But I at least don't think it's likely to be due to the new models you're up against.
So I think that the way you just handle new rules and stuff like this and things you're not accustomed to is take the 5 minutes or the 2 minutes or the 3 minutes or like whatever during your opponent's deployment to just read the cards. Like, just sit down, read them, see what they do, ask your opponent the questions that are relevant to what you need to know. I do this almost every game I play now. If I play against something I'm not super familiar with or like I'm a little bit rusty on, I'll just sit down and read the cards. If I'm down 2 minutes on my clock, 3 minutes on my clock because I had a conversation with my opponent about what his stuff could do, but I don't get gotcha'd or I don't get fucked on a rule because of it, I think that's only beneficial to you, and the clock time you lose is not that negative.
So with that being said, obviously Mark III, we're still kind of operating with the same 60 minutes that was standard with Mark II. But Theme Forces has given us free points. Like in a Crucible Guard list, I could take 21 free points, right? Is that right? I think that's right. So is 60 minutes still sufficient? Or is the 60 minutes tied to Steamroller? Because a lot of games are going all the way to turn 7B. What are you guys' thoughts on 60 minutes as a time?
I think that 60 minutes is largely fine. It's a conscious choice to play more things with more expensive models. As a very real example here, my Denny 2 list was a remarkably deep set of questions I had to ask myself every turn and measurements I had to do. And I specifically chose simple models in the list to allow myself time to think and act, without straining my clock super hard and burning my brain juice. And that was a conscious choice in list design to not clock myself every game, seeing ghosts on the table when I had a million plays I could make every turn. And I think that if you're struggling with clock and it's something you can't play the 60 dude list in 60 minutes, then maybe you need to adjust or maybe build more muscle memory. I think 60 minutes is fine.
Yeah. So kind of to Matt's point, it's never really been about the model count to me. Whether it's a list that has in effect only 12 to 15 models, if it's like a fairly battle group intensive list, to ones that have between 30 and 40, the times I find myself difficult on clock are when I'm not familiar with my own models. Generally, the worst I ever feel on clock is when I pick up a newer list, if I'm testing something new or a new caster, and I have to keep referencing back to their cards to try and remember the command range on a unit, or what's the base mat or rat or the power and strength or whatever it is. Just really whatever could be on the card that I don't just have committed to muscle memory or memorized to recall without having to look, is when I find myself difficult on clock. Like the model count was almost arbitrary. As long as I was able to know without having to look, I was usually always on time. And when it's funny, when I first started playing that the list I'm on right now, that's Negra 1 list, it's got a handful of models in it that I've used before. It was my first time playing that, but knowing all of the models in it made it very quick and easy to pick up. Whereas when I was playing a list at the beginning of this year, it was like this Denegra 1 list in Black Industries that had like 12 models in it. It was my first time using a lot of them in the past year plus. Those games were a lot harder for me on clock, only because I had to keep checking to make sure I wasn't fucking up my own rules.
I think there is something to be said, though, with model count. Like, if you're playing just a huge dude spam, you need to understand that you can't expect to take quality attacks and quality activations with every single model in your list every single turn and expect to not clock. I think there is something to be said about huge count, you know, large model count armies.
Yeah, you're 100% right.
Yeah, so before you jump in, this was kind of the Crix problem at the end of Mark II. Or I shouldn't say the problem, but the problem that Crix posed at the end of Mark II. There were lists in Crix that had, 50 or like 40-something Mechanithralls and then a pile of guys behind that as well. Especially when Iron Gauntlet was like a 75-point in Mark II thing. It was just a pile of models. And the question that always came up to players that were running it and doing well with it was, how do you activate and do all those models without running out of time? And the answer that still kind of rings true now, I shouldn't say kind of, it does still ring true, is every turn you don't need all of your models to do everything, right? Like, you only need a few models to do enough work to still keep you relevant on scenario and to kind of take out your opponent's most critical pieces. And then beyond that, you just get to flood the table and then make your opponent spend the time to kill your models. It'll take them more time to kill your models than it will to take you to move them in a spot where they have to be killed for them to not get completely boxed on scenario.
So with all that being said,
Well, I don't want to move past that one just yet. Matt, is that your same take on Horde style list?
This is my theory in everything, is only make the attacks you need to make to win the game at the pace you need to win it. So like a lot of the time in my games, I run models a lot, just run them to better positions, forfeit their theoretical attacks, because wasting the 5 minutes on clock to figure out what I want to attack, how I want to attack, what kind of dice I need to roll, all that stuff, to kill some models I don't really care about killing, is almost never beneficial. It's almost always more beneficial to have that 5 minutes on turn 7 when you're usually down to 2-3 minutes to figure out your turn. I guess it's look at your clock as a credit card as opposed, or look at your clock as a debit account, and you can't spend more than you have. So plan accordingly. And if you're going to spend 5 minutes making, 20 attacks on turn 2 into garbage that you're probably don't need to kill on turn 2, save the time.
P, I didn't mean to cut you off. Any thoughts to add on the...
That's fine. I was going through and looking to make sure that, we answered. And our writer, Nicholas, brought up an interesting concept here in that should the amount of time that we have be based off of a model count, right? If you have basically, 60 models in your army and I have 10, should there be a weighing of the clock?
I mean, then having more models that you don't need to activate gives you a clear advantage. The person with more time is at a distinct advantage versus the person with less time, no matter the amount of models on the table. I don't think there's any way you could balance that system in a way that makes sense when one of the main balancing factors of the game is that we all have to adhere to this clock. And because we all have to adhere to the unifying factor, it creates a situation in which all players involved have to play by the same rules in terms of army design, play time on the table, and it creates a unifying sense of the game.
I'm definitely agree with you. I like to look not at the number of models in a list, but I like to look at the number of meaningful attacks, right? So for instance, look at a suppressor. He has two initial melees and then two sprays. And compare that to a Toro who has two initials, period. So I can get, 5 attacks on a Toro or who knows how many attack rolls that I have to make with a suppressor. If I do it right, I'm doing 20 easily because of the sprays. So I need to allocate more time for that suppressor than I do really for the Toro. So, I mean, that's one thing with a dude spam army is that, you know, if you're looking at something like, we'll go back to the venerable Mechanithral, there's not really a situation in which you're going to be making his Mechanithral's two initial attacks. They're going to be combo attacking every turn and moving on. So you can get through 10 attacks with a full unit of Mechanithrals pretty easily compared to something that has dual attacks and up to four initials, you know, that kind of thing.
I just think that the most important thing when we talk about clock as a balancing factor for the game in terms of how we play is that, like, the core understanding of it is that we have to, every player playing on the clock has to adhere to that time. And giving players advantages or disadvantages on the clock dramatically changes the way at which a player can play the game. I practice locally on 45 to 50 minute clocks. This is like something I practice on. My locals try to play on shorter clocks too. And when we play in tournament settings and we're playing on a 45 minute clock and our opponents are playing on an hour, or even when we're playing casual games like this, that extra 15 minutes at the end of the game means that we don't realistically get the last two turns of the game. Like, we have to ration out. We're missing two turns of the game total versus our opponent, who gets to play all seven. And we have to win the game in that setting. And that's a clock advantage or disadvantage in that setting. Like, a person playing on five more minutes means that he gets an entire turn seven versus his opponent who doesn't.
Brad, do you have anything to add?
No, so I just more so a question really for Matt there. So in the tournament setting locally, you have players that will hold themselves accountable that if they get down to 15 minutes, they're going to concede the game on clock.
I mean, it depends on the player. I generally don't hold myself to conceding to the game on clock if I'm down that low. I make a mental note of when I exceed my clock. And I'm like, okay, cool, I would have lost this round. But I mean, it's more so a move to get ready for rushing through turns and helping you rationalize what you need to do.
Yeah, so like I haven't recently, but I have practiced games where you know, only take 45 or 50 minutes as opposed to the full 60. But at least in tournament settings, all that really does is at least after those practice games for me, when you get to the tournament, by like round three, you look over and you're just surprised, like, oh, I still have a lot of time left. And it's just like that really nice, refreshing feeling, and it puts you in like a really comfortable, or at least comfortable feeling position. You know, it doesn't always mean you're winning the game, but practicing on lower clock, all it means is that the tournaments after that is it's just a level of comfort on clock that you don't get if you don't put yourself in that position in the practice games.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. One of the best experiences for me was playing on 45 minute clocks all before WTC. And then our first round at WTC, I sit at the table and like I finish my turn and I'm like, man, that took a little bit. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm thinking myself, I'm going a little bit slow. My opponent finishes his turn. It took him 20 minutes. I look over. I'm like, oh, I still have 50 minutes on my clock. Oh, I get what? I don't even.
Wow. Huh. So are there things we can do to improve our time? Personally, for me, one of the things that I try to identify, there's going to be one or two turns where you go into the clock. And I try to make a conscious decision of, okay, Pete, you have to the count of 15 to get out of this think tank and actually do something. If all it is allocate your focus, you don't spend a lot of time in tank. What do you guys do to try to improve your clock play other than playing with a smaller amount of clock?
So I think the thing that people don't talk about enough but needs to be discussed is make your basic plans during your opponent's turn. I know it can be kind of hard to watch what your opponent's doing and like absorb the information of what they're doing and also plan out your turn, but like figure out what pieces need to be where and what needs to do what. Like, you should always have your focus allocation plan finished by the time your opponent ends his turn. You should also probably have your first five activations finished by your time your opponent finishes his turn. I think that's the most important thing. If you can get that down, you're going to save 10 minutes over the course of the game. I think that the second most important thing is to not commit to over convoluted plans and like multi-step difficult processes just to get a little bit of value. Go for the easily attainable things first, and if you end up being getting those easily attainable things, then transition into the harder things. Nothing eats up clock time like planning out a 20-minute run to get a CP when you could have just had a 5-minute run to get a better board position.
Does it make sense? So one of the things, you know, I definitely do try to plan on my opponent's turn, but what I do is when they pass the turn, I go through and I try to confirm the truths that I know. So I'll be like, okay, so this model has admonition, these two models have countercharge, this model has stealth, and I'll go through that with my opponent. Is that a good practice, or am I just wasting time?
I do that every turn of every game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%.
Because, okay. You know, obviously one of the worst things you can do is, okay, I'm going to dedicate this time, come up with this brilliant plan, and then, oh, that model has knockdown on countercharge, and I've just lost all that time, and now I have to spend more time coming up with a new plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so 100% ask your opponent questions, figure out information before you commit to things. But I think I think a really good example of what I'm talking about here is one of my WTC teammates from last year, Jeremy McClure, a great War Machine player. His biggest problem in War Machine is clock. He struggles with it immensely. And it's not because he's slow, it's because he tries to win as hard as possible every single turn. So every single turn he spends time in the tank, figuring things out, planning out his turn, and then goes and does it. But like the problem with that, when you're trying to win as hard as possible every turn, is that clock is a resource. And when you try to win that hard on scenario or assassination or attrition, you're spending your resource that is clock. So if your opponent is like, I'm just not going to lose. And you're like, I'm going to win as hard as possible. He's going to end up being super advantaged on clock. So don't ever forget that clock is a resource and a win condition and like a way to pressure other conditions of victory. So just because you're winning really hard on attrition, but you're super down on clock doesn't mean you're going to win the game or lose the game. Like you have to manage all of these resources. So I guess don't try to win as hard as possible all the time. Sometimes taking a small victory and saving clock time is the way to go.
Does it make sense to try to play on time turns in addition to death clock? If you can get those games, right? If you can get like four or five games in a week, maybe dedicate one or two to playing on time turns.
So I don't know if time turns are especially relevant, but I would say that whatever method you want to do, whether it's a shortened death clock or time turns, putting yourself in a higher pressure timed element in your game nights or your practice games, if you're trying to improve yourself for the weekend steamrollers or whatever, only helps your game, right? So like being able to either take your turn quickly enough to play on time turns to identify what the key activations are each round, whether it's for scenario or for attrition value, is extremely important. Or if it's just being able to play the entire game with a shortened death clock, knowing when you're better off, just as Matt was saying before, running models as opposed to taking kind of the dinky throwaway attacks that don't really get you anything in the long game. Whatever your method is, whether it's time turns or shortened death clock, I think both are fine methods for improving your game on time.
What about playing into a list that's designed to eat your clock? Things like Haley 3, any of the recursive Clockwork Legion type of lists, the Immortal list from Scorn, right? The recursive type of lists. What are some strategies that players can do for those clock intensive lists to fight?
So when playing against a list that has recursion, because they're not going anywhere, while the models that exist in them may change, whether it's the Undead Pirates or the Stone Boys from Immortals, to the soul, the robots with souls and convergence. Recursion lists are going to be around. They'll exist in a couple different manners, but they, as you were saying, are going to be taking away or eating at your resource that we've been talking about this entire time, which is your clock. So kind of is what we've been talking about in a vacuum when we're not talking about specific lists, is knowing what key things you need to do each turn are. So generally those recursion lists, the models that get to come back, have pretty low defensive stats. So they're not incredibly difficult to trade with, or at least to remove them from the spot they're standing in. The real big thing in those lists, is, and this is usually true with all of them, is they'll have a small handful of models that do the majority of all the heavy lifting in the list. The flip side to that, if it's going to be a horde of models and those like the heavy lifters don't really exist, it would probably mean that their caster has a turn due to a feat or whatever else that will allow that army to really hit above its weight class. So if you're playing against it and it's the first option to where there's a couple heavy lifters, you're looking to do two things. One, what models do I have to kill that I'm able to still score scenario points or to deny them scenario points? Because if you don't let, and you just let your opponent's horde models exist everywhere, they're going to slowly grind up those control points and win the game in that manner. So you have to quickly just identify which models are in zones, which ones are not. Focus on the ones that are in zones or within four of a flag. And then secondly, if your opponent is trying to leverage one of their heavy lifters in a zone to make it so they can clear whatever you put in it next turn, just be cognizant that those are the models that are going to be doing like all of the fighting for your opponent's list. Most of all of the models being recurred are just going to be bouncing off a lot of your harder targets. And then this is true with all recursion lists as well. They are pretty much always in units. So if you're able to remove entire units, of course you go for it. Generally, your opponent will have a model hiding in the deployment zone to make it incredibly difficult, albeit most likely impossible if they measure threat ranges. So generally, if you can bring a strong scenario edge, again, to reiterate, those models, be it Ghost Fleet or like the Whip Boys and Convergence, have pretty pedestrian defensive stats. Kill what you have to for control points. They'll generally then usually bounce off you when they come back. And you just keep doing that. And if they can't leverage their ability to pressure scenario by bringing all the guys back, they may also then have a tough time leveraging attrition if they have to start overextending to get the models that you're putting up to trade with.
So I think Brad touched on a couple really key points. And I think that the most important thing, the kind of the overarching voice here, is do the attacks you need to win and don't do anything else. Like, identify what you need to do to win, do that, and don't waste time on other shit. Because just as it takes you time to kill their shit, it takes them a lot of time to recur, activate, do things. So if you have quick turns, it puts pressure on them, and they can, and players with lots of models can end up feeling that pressure. Like, they can misactivate, keep leaders in bad positions, make mistakes because they're rushing. So do focus on what you need to do to win, and don't be extravagant.
I mean, as a guy that used to play Ghost Fleet a lot, kind of a lot of 2018, because when it fell out of favor, when people stopped bringing the tools for it, some of the rougher games were where my opponent just identified the scenario elements, killed the models I put to contest things, just kind of ran models into difficult spots after that, and then passed turn. Right, like, they weren't fighting my army. They were just fighting the colored zones on a table. Right, like, everything else didn't matter. It may as well not have existed. Just kill what I have to, pass turn, score my 2 points, deny your points that you're scoring, and keep grinding a scenario lead. And usually those recursion lists are playing for like round 5+. They're not usually having like an explosive scenario turn. So if you deny them the ability to play that long game, it can really put on a lot of pressure.
Oh, sorry. I was on mute there after a coughing fit. So yeah, all very valuable points of interest. So let me just make sure that there's nothing to do. Let's see. We already talked about thinking on opponent's turn as a tactic.
So there, just while you're reading through the next thing, Pete, there was a thing that when Matt was talking about it that I wanted to add that I do a little differently. I agree that I will also begin the planning stages on my opponent's turn, know how I'm going to do focus within reason. What's a little different is at least for me, is my my planning or what I'll intend to do with the models I'm activating that turn will change depending on the time I have left. So if it's round two, I'm not really holding myself to being 100% mindful on clock. That doesn't mean I'm spending an exorbitant amount of time planning. But what I do mean with that is I'll spend the minute or two to plan because I have the time to try and have a really, really strong turn two. I'm not trying to blow out the game. I'm not trying to make every model get its 100% max activation. But I'm identifying three, maybe four goals that I want to achieve this turn, whether it's landing different spots on scenario elements or scoring different scenario elements or trying to remove some of my opponent's key pieces or keeping something safe. But then as we get later into the game and time starts to get a little tighter, I'll start kind of looking at the clock. And if it's the beginning of round five and I have 15 minutes left, I'll kind of hold it to myself that I'm not going to spend more than 7 minutes this turn. Like, I want to have my last two turns to have 8 minutes. Then for round six, I'm going to try and spend right around five to have 3 minutes left. And then generally, if you're in a spot to where control points are tight, and you're just trying to get those couple last control points to be able to contest your opponent's spots on that last round of the game, 3 minutes is generally more than enough time to activate the one or two models you'll need to kill one of your opponent's contesting pieces and run the models where you need them to go. But it almost pains me when I watch games and I see opponents start getting into that late game where they both know it's going to round seven kind of thing. And they're treating their round five as if it's their round two. They're trying to get every model to activate to its fullest potential. They're trying to trade really effectively. They're trying to give nothing away, which are all really great things in practice. But at that point in the game, that's not 100% the game you're playing. Like, you can't throw all of that out the window and throw all your models haphazardly to the wind and just start kind of activating whatever order you want. But at the same time, you're not trying to take perfect turns at that point. You're trying to put the pressure on your opponent and make sure you have more time left than them so you can take better turns as the game gets later.
So I think that there's a key point here. You mentioned perfect turns. I think a really big thing that a lot of people struggle with, and especially Meltdown on Clock about, is looking for that perfect turn. It just doesn't exist. A perfect turn is not a thing in War Machine. Because of how dice work and foresight and hindsight and all of that stuff. You can't know how things are going to go until you do them. And
So let's not fixate on perfect turn. Then maybe that was the incorrect word. Optimal, strong, maybe not even strongest, just strong, right? Like, however you'd want to take that one word. But I mean, spending the extra time to make your turn as good as you could make it be. Maybe perfect was too strong of a word.
There's definitely perfect. There's perfect for you as a player. Like, okay, I've gotten value out of every single decision that I've made. And whether, you know, the dice support that, you've placed your models in a good place. You didn't forget to activate this. Your order of activation was correct. You know, you've done as much as you possibly can outside of the random number generator to the best of your ability. I think that would be a perfect turn.
I mean, I don't even think those exist. I think that War Machine is a game of mistakes. Every player playing the game makes a series of mistakes. And a quote-unquote perfect turn only exists in the hindsight of your opponent's decisions. So, like, you don't know what mistakes you made until your opponent exposes them to you. Because, like, that's how War Machine works. Like, you don't know if that warjack's positioning is perfect because your opponent's going to have a counterplay where he's going to position his warjack. He's going to position his unit. He's going to position his caster. And now your thing's out of position for where it needed to be. It's just not a reality that you can have a quote unquote perfect turn or like even like a really great turn. Like, your opponent's going to try to fuck you as hard as he can. And the best you can hope for is that you get to fuck him harder.
Just as a point of order real quick, Matt, as part of the Mark Howard Dojo, we don't fuck our opponents. We make sweet love to them.
Fair enough. I mean, I just mean like every game of War Machine ever played on a table has been imperfect and full of mistakes. And like you can have strong turns. You can have really great turns where you table your opponent's entire army and you leave them with no response other than to concede or maybe you just kill their caster, whatever. You can always have turns like that. But like in a game of piece trading and like negotiating table space and spending resources, it's just so hard to predict what your opponent's going to try to do to stop you from getting value out of your pieces. And a lot of the time, you're going to think something's perfect and you're gonna think something's optimal, and it's just not going to be.
Right. I think my bigger point to everything I was making before, though, was that my turns, and I think this is true with a lot of players, I don't think I'm saying anything revolutionary, but my turns will be different depending on the amount of time I have left, with the forethought in of how many rounds are still left to go in the game.
Yeah, 100%. I wasn't trying to correct you or say you were wrong in any way. I was just adding to your point that a clarification about perfect game versus reality of the game, right? And I think that playing as the time you have on your clock, like as Bradley said, you need to play the game that's on the table. And clock is definitely something that's on the table and you need to be aware of. I win a lot of games on turn 7 when my opponent has like 13 seconds left. And he has to clear models out of the zone. Well, if in the last two turns, if he activated 15 seconds faster, you'd have time to do it. But it's just like that's the nature of the game, right? Like everything costs resources, whether it be time or the models themselves. You have to wager all those resources against each other.
Generally, how much time do you feel comfortable? And I'll address this to Matt, and then Brad, you can answer it. Turn 6, you pass clock and you look at the clock. I'm sorry, turn 5, you pass the clock and you look down at your clock. What number makes you feel comfortable? What number makes you feel uncomfortable?
Depends entirely on the table situation.
Okay.
If I have a minute left on my clock and my opponent has only his caster left and I'm up 4 CPs, I am super comfortable. But in like a standard game, the rule I try to adhere to is have first turn and deployment done in 6 minutes. So deploy, do your first turn runs positioning within 6 minutes. Turn 2, have it done unless you're doing a lot of work. Have turn 2 done within 10 minutes. Turn 3 is going to be your worker turn. You want to have that done within 15 minutes. Turn 4, 5, they should be done within 10 minutes each. And then turn 6, 7 should realistically be done within 5-ish minutes.
So Matt, just adding all that up, that's 51 minutes.
Yep.
6, so you have 15, 10, 5, and 5, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I recorded that because that's how I'm going to live my life now.
That's what I try to adhere to. Jake Wilstrop, when I was learning how to play Halley 3, gave me this formula. He said, Matt, this is what your timing has to be if you want to be successful with Halley 3. So I took that information and applied it to everywhere in the game because if it's good enough for Halley 3, it's good enough for everything. That's what I try to live my War Machine life by. And it can be rough. You have 9 minutes of play there. So my rule with that 9 minutes is you use it on the turn you really need it. Usually it's like 4 minutes on one turn, 5 on the other. Sometimes it's you spend 5 minutes in the tank one turn to figure out the turn before shit. But like you have that little margin of error where you can really spend time when you need it. And you only get that margin by rushing through turns where you can rush through.
Brad, do you have any thoughts on your perfect game with timing and such like that?
No, I mean, I agree with Matt that perfect was too strong of a word. I think this game is just about impossible to have perfect, but I don't think I've followed that timing formula that Matt laid out. I think it's certainly a strong goal to have and makes a lot of sense in generally how the game will flow. And if you can stick to it, that means that you're going to be crushing that round 6 and round 7 time advantage over your opponent, and they'll really feel that pressure.
Awesome. So I think we're going to start to wrap this up. Is there any last thing on clock?
Yeah, I got something. I think that a lot of players get super, super insecure and confused and frustrated at dealing with the clock, especially when they're trying to level up. I think that you just have to accept that getting better on the clock is not just a process of like managing time. It's also a process of getting better in the scope of the game. and making decisions faster. And sometimes you just have to make bad decisions on the, like, make bad decisions to have more time. And like, you just have to accept that you're going to lose games because you spent too long trying to make good decisions.
That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, if I had any closing thoughts, it's I'd say for about 80% of the game, clock won't matter. And I'd imagine that, and the math doesn't work out 100% right, but really the clock generally only comes up in the last two rounds of a game if you guys are both cognizant of it and know you're both playing to round seven. There are certainly games where players will clock out well before that round six, seven mark.
Hashtag Brett Fogle.
Okay, I mean, I wasn't going to name drop anyone, but yes.
Top of two.
But what I'm getting at is if you both know that you're playing the long game and you've recognized that before your opponent, so you can start trying to conserve that time before they are, and you can get into that point to where you're able to take better turns than they are because that's what time permits. It just makes closing out a game, it doesn't make it a sure thing, but it certainly makes it easier. So generally, I don't think it matters how, but if you have the ability to practice, if you are going to game nights or getting friendly games in before the actual events for local steamrollers or whatever you're competing in, do what you can to hold yourself to a harder time standard. It'll only improve your game.
Yeah, so one of the things that we'll do sometimes, especially with a brand new list, is we will just set a two-hour timer. Regardless of how much clock is used and regardless of where the game state is, I'm not going to lie, there's nothing worse than a game of War Machine off the clock, because now you can take every single agonizing second to figure out, you know, the quote-unquote perfect line of play. So we'll both agree that, hey, you know, we're going to take this 2 hours out of our day, we're going to play this list. You get that once to get the feel of the list, and then any game after, you're playing on the clock. So I think that's a good practice if you're trying something brand spanking new and you have no idea, you know, how it's going to play.
I mean, play the game in whatever way is fun for you and your friends. If you all hate playing on the clock, then take the time and be a genius at War Machine and figure out the optimal plays and play off the clock, because at the end of the day, it's a toy. It's, we're playing with toy soldiers, and you have to do what's fun for you,
sir,
and your friends.
Sir, they're action figures.
I mean, you can call them whatever you want. I call them war dollies. All right. But like a lot of the time, especially when I'm playing with my friends, we play on shorter clocks. Sometimes when I'm playing with other people, I'll let them have a little bit more time on their clock. I'll have less. You gotta do what's fun and what's enjoyable. That's the most important thing in this game.
Perfect. So I think with that, we're going to call it a night for Fully Boosted. This has been Pete.
Brad.
Matt.
Thanks for listening.
How do I end it? Yeah, that's how we do it.
Yeah, what Bradley said.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.